Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You who were given by water of my divine.
From newsounds.org, this is the Soundcheck podcast series. Live performances in our New York studio, streaming live on Facebook and YouTube. I'm John Schaefer. Nick Waterhouse writes contemporary songs about contemporary topics, but he uses the musical language of a half century ago, early rock, classic R&B, soul. It's a winning combination and has been over the course of now four records. The most recent is simply called Nick Waterhouse. Here's Nick with his band with a live performance of Song for Winners. That is Nick Waterhouse and the band live here in our studio with Song for Winners. It's from the most recent Nick Waterhouse LP. And features Nick, of course, singing and playing guitar. But let me introduce you to the other members of the band. Standing next to him, Jessica Wilkes on bass and backing vocals. Carol Hatchett also singing. The horns, Mando Durame playing the tenor sax and Paula Thompson the baritone sax. Judd Nielsen playing our piano and his own keyboard, and Jay Rudolph behind the drum kit. Nick, to you and the band, so glad to have you here with us in the studio today.
Thank you. It's really a pleasure to be here.
So the musical language of that song is something we associate with tunes about summer romance, teenagers in love, listening to your favorite song on the radio. But then when you get to the lyrics, It's kind of a biting, even bitter little ditty that you've written there.
Ain't it, though? You know, one of my favorite quotes that I think is really the cornerstone of my entire life was Lester Bangs was writing about Them. And he was writing about
The band Them.
Yeah, the band Them with Van Morrison. And he said, this was in the early 70s, he goes, some people really knew that the most cosmic and psychedelic experience you could have was cruising to the burger stand listening to Gloria with its double drumming going. And that's kind of, I think that might be the way that I arrived at the place I'm at.
So this combination of, you know, often very contemporary and sometimes dark-hued lyrics with a sound that we, to this day, feel is full of kind of nostalgia and sunshine and the beach and stuff. What do you get from that kind of creative tension?
Well, it's like the history of popular music, and I mean, even the blues is about juxtaposing two different feelings. And, you know, I think the language that I happened to learn as a young man when I was listening to records and playing guitar, it might have been rooted in that, but I think, you know, a lot of the people who were working on some of those tunes, I think of like Burt Burns writing Peace of My Heart, or like some of those really great like Bobby Blue Bland or Junior Parker songs, those can be pretty dark, and there's like a minor tinge to all of it. I think people tend to get hung up on like period aesthetics, and for me, I think we're far enough into modern music that, you know, we have to decide whether we're gonna keep something under glass or if it's a language, you know?
Right.
And I think of it as a language. My parents weren't even around for the malt shop days, which is something that I think some people tend to conjure up when they hear my guitar playing, at least.
Well, now, it's funny that you mention that because, you know, listening to you on record and even the solo you took at the end of Song for Winners, you tend towards these short, stinging guitar solos as opposed to the, you know, kind of more flamboyant, long-held tones and stuff, because you play without foot pedals.
That's true. Yes.
So you don't have access to all of that, you know, the fuzz and the sustain and all of that other stuff that most other guitarists have developed over the years. You're talking about speaking a language. You're speaking a language from decades ago when you do that.
I think so. I mean, I think what I like about my project is I have to split myself. So there's the guitarist in me where if I'm soloing and I'm using my language of like what I've learned, I'm a fauvist, like I'm a primitive. I don't believe in florid things. Like that's my statement as a guitar player.
Mm-hmm.
But the other half is that I'm a songwriter and I make records and I work in service of the song or the record. So I think what you're talking about with these sort of like lift off solos that take somebody somewhere, it seems like all those seem to keep taking people the same place, and maybe I want to go in a different direction, and that's actively like what I think that I do as a guitar player. It's hard to harp on this, but I spent so much time in clubs listening to 45s, and those were always in service of the rhythm and not about soloists, really.
Right, yeah. Right. And you're also a producer, and as a producer, you make conscious decisions in the studio about what the song is going to sound like.
Absolutely.
Again, in the decades since the 50s and 60s, recordings have become slicker. There's a kind of a glossy sheen to most things. So when I hear a saxophone with not an ounce of reverb on it, or even more striking, the backing singers come in without a speck of reverb being used, that is a really startling kind of sonic effect today.
Yeah, and that's what the inside of my mind sounds like. I hate to say homogenous. I don't want to be the person who's like contrarian in that sense, but just most of the things that happen in popular music don't appeal to me. Just flat out, I can say that. And yeah, sonic palettes are what's interesting and fun for me if I'm making a record. I definitely would try the sax with a verb or not, and if it felt right, I would do it. And I'm kind of just following that instinct and that impulse.
And I don't want to give the impression that it's all the time that the voices and the, because
yeah,
there are.
Yeah, sure.
So when you do make that decision to dial it back to zero reverb, in its own subtle way, even if you don't notice it, I think probably, you know, you would feel it somehow.
You hear it or you feel it.
Yeah.
I guess I'm ideological in that sense. Like I'm laying out an ideology in how I produce my records. not making them for the sake of making them in a fetishistic way, but I'm pointing out, you know what, maybe I don't like all these high frequencies, or I don't like these lush reverbs, or I like it when you can hear a squeak, or like, one of my favorite things in the world is on this Irma Thomas track, there's a second verse where the triangle player drops his triangle and you can hear it. Yeah.
The beginning of Brown Sugar by the Rolling Stones, where you hear Keith's fingers squeak on the strings.
Absolutely. That's the terroir of American music. Yeah. Like, why eliminate the
soil?
Why
would you take that out?
Yeah, yeah, sure. Yeah.
So how did you make this record? Was this like, you know, done old-fashioned analog tape the whole way?
Yeah. We cut it. We tracked it. It's funny, though. It was very modern, like... I wrote a lot of these songs over iMessage with a friend of mine. All my demos are iPhone memos. And we flew in some players and brought some of my favorite LA players. And I met new people like Mondo, who played tenor on the record. And we did it in a couple days at this studio called Electrovox that just had like a beautiful live room. And this guy, Woody Jackson, runs it, and he's maintained it beautifully.
Mm-hmm.
And we cut it to tape. And then we took the reels from there up to my co-producer Paul Butler's home studio and finished it up there on his mixing desk, doing overdubs and making decisions about mixing. So it was almost like, again, that split had to happen where I could go sit in the control room in hindsight and pull up the tapes and mix the band almost like live as we were doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So lots of compartmentalization required.
Absolutely.
For this.
Yeah.
We're speaking with Nick Waterhouse and hearing some music from his most recent LP. This next song goes back a number of years.
Yeah, it's really close to my heart. The words were written by my friend Pedram, who's the guitar player in the Alalas, and I was making my album and their first record at the same time.
You were producing their record.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like that whole year was, it was like we were all making the same record. Everybody was playing on each other's records, and we were doing a bunch of co-bills, and we toured. Our first tours were together, and this one has always been sort of like, again, this is my world. Like it's lyrics written by an LA kid, and it feels like blues for surfers or something. You know what I mean? It's called "Don't You Forget It."
All right, here's Nick Waterhouse.
Can't talk to. Yeah, I think I found someone just might replace you. And she don't care if I got bread. Hey, I remember everything she said. Well, I think that she would do. Get it.
The song is Don't You Forget It, Nick Waterhouse and the band playing live. And Nick, you mentioned before playing the song that it dates back to the period when you were producing your first record and the A La La's first record. They covered this song, which presumably you produced that version.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd say it's their song. It's just like it was like a little love letter between friends. You know?
Yeah.
And that was a lonely period for all of us. You know, my really good friend Matt, the drummer, his girlfriend kicked him out because he wasn't doing anything with his life. That was a very trying time for a few young men. You know,
yeah.
So, that's from Time's All Gone, the first record of mine.
Right, right. It's interesting to compare your version to the A La La's version, though, because theirs is very guitar-driven and almost sounds like a lost song from The Animals or The Zombies or one of those bands. Your version, with prominent horns and organ, almost sounds like Charles Brown, you know, the great...
that's very flattering. Okay.
Yeah, sure.
You're actually from the Bay Area, aren't you? So you know Charles Brown's blues pianist.
Mm-hmm.
Did you grow up listening to that sort of thing?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was hard, but it was easier than it probably has been in the past. I was born in '86, so when I started going to the library, like, and using the internet like a library in the early 2000s, late '90s. If I was into some guitar player or, I saw a picture of somebody that looked cool, like Muddy Waters, I'd be like, who's that? I like his white shoes. Oh, man, he did all this, you know. And so I was always a curious person. And when you're listening to songs, especially in the American vernacular and its interaction with the larger world, like British rock and roll, all that stuff, it's a big, like a continuum. So... You know, I found out about probably like Johnny Moore and Charles Brown and the King Cole Trio because people like Bobby Blue Bland and R&B singers were talking about them, and I found out about those R&B singers because rock and roll guitar players were talking about them. And you know, you realize that it was almost like an oral history. It wasn't, you know, just product. Yeah. It wasn't just product for sale.
Well, and you know, going back to the rock bands of the '60s is how most of us learned about, you know, Robert Johnson, Muddy Waters, all those guys. I mean, but it's so much easier now that you just click on a website and there it is.
Maybe you don't engage the same way.
I wonder if that's the case.
The obsession can't grow as strong if you're just provided with it like a drip.
So do you feel like you had to work hard enough for your obsession that it actually did take kind of deep hold? And
I mean, I'm playing guitar in front of you right now, man.
Without pedals.
Yeah, with no pedals and conventional tuning. You know, I think so. I think if you care enough about something, it reveals itself to you, and that was kind of what I think happened with my deal.
Yeah.
Don't you forget it. Again, like my own writing and my own work, I'm very interested in rhythm and arrangement, and I'd say that other projects are more oriented toward guitar playing, and mm-hmm. and that's something that probably somebody who grew up listening to that stuff wants to play, you know?
Well, you know, you talk about American vernacular music, and there has been a change in the sort of the top 20, top 40 in American popular music since 1980 for sure, and possibly even before that, which is in the 60s and 70s and up till around 1980, you could occasionally find an instrumental track
right.
on the top 10, on yeah. the top 20.
Somebody go out and download Elviv like 8,000 times so I can chart with that. I want to.
Now, so is that why you recorded Elviv as an instrumental?
I recorded Elviv because it was fun.
Yeah. You know?
That's it's as a friend said, that's a lot of money for just fun, but it's what I do. That's, yeah.
Now, the song you're going to play next for us, Black Glass, is this cut from the same cloth as the Black Mirror TV series? Is this?
You know what's sad is that I wrote Black Glass down right before Black Mirror came out, but I suppose it addresses similar issues.
Right. The idea that these little screens are everywhere.
Yeah, and I think if you read the lyrics, Black Glass occurs in the second verse, and the premise of this is actually about like a lattice of a power structure. And like the invasive sort of like postmodern or neoliberal way in which you, like all of us, whether we like it or not, we're volunteered for a giant project that none of us know how it's going to end in terms of technology and power.
We also didn't really know all the stakes when we
nor did
volunteered.
We know the stakes. Yeah. Iggy Pop gave a really amazing speech about why he bought Apple stock in the early 90s, and it's because he said capitalists finally figured out how to take the feel-good vibe of the 60s and package it to sell it to all of us.
He always was ahead of the curve, wasn't he?
Well, that's why he lives in Miami now. Anyway, this, you know, this tune is like, I don't believe in despair at the end of the day. I think you can despair, but when I sing Adapt or Die, that might be a little sardonic.
Mm-hmm.
It might also be just addressing, again, like, Adam Curtis said that part of the failure of art right now is that it's not revealing systems of power. It's complicit in it by continuing to perpetuate systems of power. So this is all I can do is play my guitar and sing about it. You know.
All right. Well, I'll let you do that then. Nick Waterhouse and his band are here with us. The album is called simply Nick Waterhouse, his fourth and most recent. Here's the song, Black Glass.
I've got a question. My father, yeah, my father never had to ask him these kind of things. I don't think they happened in the past. I've been walking on the Strasse, I've been strolling on the boulevard. Long before cold computing, you know they handled cars. In a sea of indecision,
somebody
unblock the dam. They don't know you or I am.
Now
we get to live our own 100 visions. We didn't it. It's enough to make you cry. We didn't ask. Hey, adapt or die. Black glass, I've seen things. things come. My father, yeah, my father never saw pads behind a red wheel, only seeing seats under the red lights. Well, he'd say, who are they? And who gave them the right?
Waterhouse and the band that stops on a dime with Black Glass. You'll find it on the new album, also called Nick Waterhouse. Nick, this is your fourth record, but the first one to be just titled with your name.
Yeah.
So is this kind of a statement of some sort of identity or intent that the first three records were leading up to?
Like everything I do, it's not a joke, but it's very lighthearted. I thought it'd just be funny to have my fourth record my own name.
Okay.
But once we were putting the record together, I realized I was saying the most about, like, everything's in there. I learned each of my first three, which almost feel like a trilogy to me, there's like a different muscle group, and they all sort of coalesced in this one. If someone were to walk into a record shop, I think I would want them actually to, like, start here.
Yeah.
Maybe get into it and then go back. But when you live in the world of content, there's also this thing where I'm just trying to play a joke on everyone because it's like they got to put my picture up every day on social media and post about stuff and ask me to make playlists all the time. There's no break, so why not just make something like really simple and self-titled?
What goes on a Nick Waterhouse playlist?
Oh, let's see. What goes on right now? We were listening to some Boz Scaggs last night.
Old Boz Scaggs or the new stuff?
Silk Degrees.
That's the old, the classic,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah. You know, I love...
I guess that was a silly question to ask, wasn't it?
Yeah, here's what goes on the Nick Waterhouse playlist. Here's what goes on the Nick Waterhouse playlist. Ben Pirani and the Means of Production, who are a really amazing New York band that just put out a record on Coal Mine. The Ringleaders... Barbara Green, Mondo over there on the YouTube playing me doo-wop 45s that I had never heard before. You know, Don and Dee Dee, Johnny Guitar Watson, yeah, Otis Rush and the Kings of Rhythm behind him, Dionne Warwick. Just, it's everything. It's, yeah. You know, that's what's on a playlist. It changes day to day. That's the beauty of it right now.
Okay, and where do these playlists live?
They live in the moment when we're in the van.
Oh, okay. So when you say people ask you to make playlists, it's not like a Spotify playlist or anything like that.
Yeah, you know, it used to be that there were all these magazines right before Spotify became like the dominating force of it, and I would make these MP3 lists that I would have to like compress and send in. I also have made I do the Reverberation podcast, which is with Alalaz and some other friends. So I have some episodes on there. And, you know, I've done stuff for like Vice and GQ and whatever magazine will have me as the flavor of the month.
All right.
Yeah.
You sound totally excited
about
the whole
that
thing.
You know what I'm excited about? When like a record feels real good and I put it on, yeah. Not when I'm being made into like, like somebody's mule.
The album, the fourth record, is called simply Nick Waterhouse. It's on Innovative Leisure out of L.A., and Nick, it's been great having you and the folks here to play for us today.
Thank you so much for hosting us. Thank you, really, genuinely.
This is Soundcheck. That'll do it for this edition of the Soundcheck podcast, but as always, there's much more to be found on our website. Lots of other performances, video shot in the studio, the daily gig alerts, weekly music roundups, new sound shows, and more. Check it out at newsounds.org. Our technical director is Irene Trudell. Our associate producer is Karen Havlick. I'm John Schaefer. Thanks for being with us.